there were all these little things that I didn't know. And unless you have like a bra fitter mom, I think, then you don't know these things. They're not widely available. They're not really out there. And so the idea with Third Love and being direct to consumer was that we had this direct way to speak to our customer, to educate her, to bring her along the journey, to make her feel really comfortable. And so that was really what we set out to do from the early days of Third Love. That hasn't changed.
Hey, it's EB Moss, and this is episode 26 of Insider Interviews. This is pretty unbelievable because I am going to be speaking with Heidi Zack. And if you haven't heard of her, then you haven't been buying women's underwear, because she's the co-founder and CEO of Third Love, which is the third largest online bra and underwear company in America. She has been called Fast Company's most creative people, Goldman Sachs' 100 most intriguing entrepreneurs. She's one of those 40 under 40 from Fortune. She's a remarkable person, but she also has embraced brand purpose in everything she does. We're going to talk to Heidi about how she embraces brand and demand marketing and how she disrupted an entire traditional industry. Here's Heidi. I have to start out by saying that you didn't know me from Adam or Eve, and you responded to my email, and we're thrilled. It's been such a pleasure to read all about you and all that you've done. So we started talking about San Francisco. When did you live in New York?
I lived in New York after I graduated college, basically for 10 years, and then moved out to San Francisco in 2010. So I've been out here now about 11 years. So officially have lived in San Francisco longer than New York, which is interesting. Yeah.
And I lived in California for about 15 years, and I never thought I would be in one apartment for more than 20 years in New York City.
That's a long time. When I lived in New York, I had 6 apartments in 8 or 10 years. Like I feel like I moved almost every year, and it was a disaster. But
well, that's what people do. You know, that's, I think, what is most common. I feel odd staying stuck, and I'm lucky I'm right outside of Central Park. But you would think during the pandemic that I would have organized my sock drawer, or in your case, my underwear drawer. But I'm saving that till the very last moment of lock-in.
You're funny. I actually did just buy a lot of new socks. It's funny you said that. But I've done the opposite, which is my house has never been so well organized and all of that, because, you know, when you're home all the time, you start looking around and you're like, man, there's all these things that I said I would do that I never had time to do. And now I have all day long practically on the weekend. So, yeah.
You do not, Heidi. You have 2 kids. You're the CEO of a huge company. Come on now. And you organized your sock drawer?
I did. Yes, I did. But, you know, no, I mean, I don't have all the time in the world, but I do find time here and there to do the little things, because usually we would be traveling and doing all these things and soccer games. And, you know, now you don't have that. And so it's a very weird time.
I know. Well, Heidi, you have shared a lot in many, many extraordinary interviews about how you built Third Love. As we said, it's the third largest online bra and underwear company in America. Yay, you. And thank you. And I definitely want you to talk about some of that evolution for our conversation. But I really want to focus on the proverbial softer side of you and your company, your approach to marketing and to brand purpose. So can we start with the woman behind the brand? You are the proverbial small town girl, and you grew up to be a badass woman and the first to disrupt a traditional industry. Tell us a little bit about that path.
Yeah. So I grew up in a small town outside of Niagara Falls, New York, called Youngstown, which is on the Niagara River and really overlooks Lake Ontario and Toronto, so the U.S. side of the lake. And yeah, my town was 3,000 people. So my first job was working on a farmer's market. There's a lot of farms actually in Western New York. But I kind of always knew I wanted to get out and do something different and be somewhere different. And after college, moved to New York City and kind of did some traditional jobs, I would say, you know, banking and kind of consulting and business school and all of these things. And I wasn't necessarily the entrepreneurial type. You know, I can't point to all these moments where it was like, yes, I'm going to be an entrepreneur. It kind of just happened. And so between those experiences, after business school, I was at a company called Aeropostale in New York, right across the street from Macy's on 34th Street was the office. I was there for 4 years and then eventually ended up moving out to San Francisco. And it was really out here where I got bit by the entrepreneurial bug. And really, it was the environment of San Francisco. I mean, it's a very, very special place, very unique. And you're talking about kind of 2010. And it was a down market. You know, we were sort of coming out of the recession. But there was a lot of interesting founders building these really cool companies. Like, I remember going to my first startup holiday party, and I was so excited. And my husband, who's my co-founder, was friends with one of the founders of what is now Lyft, but it was called Zimride at the time.
Oh.
And we went to their holiday party, and there was maybe 20 people at the time, and they were mostly engineers coding, and they had Costco pizza. And I walked into that party, and I was walking around kind of talking to them, being like, what's Zimride? And they were like, oh, it's, you know, some app where you can like hop in somebody's car and get a ride over the Bay Bridge. And I'm thinking to myself, this is, you know, the craziest idea I've ever heard. Like, who's going to do that? This is a terrible business idea. I mean, what do I know? Obviously not a lot. And so through meeting people like that and hearing about what they were building, all of a sudden I was like, why can't I do this? Like, why can't I build something? It looks like a lot of other people are doing this and changing the world. And so from there, I had a bad bra shopping trip, and that really spurred me to take a step back. And this is 2012. So again, there weren't a lot of options to buy a bra. I mean, really in 2012, if you look at the landscape, what had existed at that time, there was department stores and Victoria's Secret and some big box, right? Walmart, Target, et cetera. And there wasn't much else. And there certainly weren't, you know, online bra brands at the time. And that was the idea. It was better brand, better product, better online shopping experience for women. And that's what we set out to build. So that's how Third Love came to be.
Okay. So I've heard you describe, and you know, that's why I said thank you earlier, because I have been in those scary dressing rooms, but you've described this aha moment. What's it like? Remind people to go into retail.
Yeah, I ask this question a lot. When I used to speak at bigger conferences, I would ask women in the audience to raise their hand if they had ever been fit for a bra. And I'd say usually it's about half of women have been fit for a bra. So if you haven't, or if you're a man and you don't understand what it's usually like, at a Victoria's Secret store, you usually have somebody with a measuring tape around her neck, and you'll be wandering around the store kind of looking for whatever you're looking for. Generally, I would always be in the camp of trying to avoid talking to somebody. And, you know, they come up and they're like, oh, do you need to get measured? And you're sort of like, no, maybe, which is what I did on my last VS shopping trip. Or you're like, yes, I want to get measured. And then they're in the fitting room with you, right? So they're measuring you, they're kind of poking and prodding. Or a really good bra fitter actually doesn't need a measuring tape. She'll sort of size you up in the bra you have on. And she'll see what's wrong, right? She'll see if you have cup gaping or your straps are slipping or if you're overflowing or all the things that can happen. And actually all of those things that a really experienced bra fitter would notice is what went into building our Fit Finder, which is now our fitting room, which we launched last week. And so the really good bra fitters, it's like magic. If you found one of those women, they bring you this new size and style and you try it on and you're like, oh my God, like I didn't realize I was whatever size in this bra just, I mean, it fits totally different and I look great. And so it could go one of two ways. So I think it's either like you get that really experienced bra fitter and it works, or you end up probably with whatever they sell in the store that they have a lot of, which for me was like a 34B, which is not my size, but it's a very popular size and it's a very well-stocked size. So there's a lot of women walking around in these really common quote unquote sizes because that's what stores have. So there's a lot of things that can go awry, but bra shopping is not fun. Let's just put it that way, right? And women tend to dread it. You know, you don't wake up in the morning being like, yay, today I get to go buy a bra. It's always kind of something that I think most women dread doing.
Yes. And bathing suits. Yeah.
Totally.
Oh, so I'm completely on the same page. And I learned a lot about bras over my entire lifetime of having to buy them, but in little doses at a time. So I didn't know that if the strap rides up in the back, that's a sign of bad fitting. I didn't know that until like 4 years in, that cup gaping was a thing, until 8 years in. So I go to your site, and there's a whole little chart. And as you described, Fit Finder launched recently. And there's, you know, illustrations. Oh, that looks like me. And this is what I have to shop for. So we used the word disruption before. What's your definition of D2C? You have said famously that that phrase didn't even exist when you launched Third Love. So how do you describe D2C then? And what does it look like now?
So I guess for us, when we were building Third Love in the early days, call it like 2012, 2013, 2014, when quote unquote direct to consumer really wasn't a term yet. It's interesting because I remember looking at the landscape being like the brands we were looking at, right, which were selling to women at the time were a Birchbox, a Rent the Runway, Warby Parker just had launched. So those were kind of a few of the names. No one was really vertically integrated in apparel in any category for the most part. And so what we set out to do and why it was important is having this direct relationship with the customer, especially in a category where we felt, to your point, education was lacking in a huge way. Even for me, like I said, until I started Third Love, I was wearing the wrong bra size. Until I started Third Love, I had never had a lace bra that I actually loved that fit me. Until Third Love, I was wearing my bra the wrong way. I was putting it on the middle or the tightest hook when I got it. And that's not how you want to wear a bra. You want it to be on the loosest hook and it should be snug when you buy it. And then over time, as it wears, you know, you move your hook in. And so there were all these little things that I didn't know. And unless you have like a bra fitter mom, I think, then you don't know these things. They're not widely available. They're not really out there. And so the idea with Third Love and being direct to consumer was that we had this direct way to speak to our customer, to educate her, to bring her along the journey, to make her feel really comfortable. And so that was really what we set out to do from the early days of Third Love. That hasn't changed. I think what's interesting today as you look at the broader market is what we've now seen is anything can be D2C. You name it, it's D2C. Any category, I mean, even categories that you wouldn't have even really thought about, they're all, you know, everybody's D2C and in some way. And even the big old school brands are now leaning much more heavily into D2C too, right? Because they need to. And COVID and the pandemic has furthered that. So it's been quite a shift in the market. If you think about 6 to 7 years ago to today, it's dramatically different.
Yeah. So I want to talk about some early stage tactics that you used. But first, I want to talk about how you had to get over some other hurdles. And another famous story that you talk about is being a woman seeking financing from primarily men. And we should note that McKinsey tells us that even with a 20% bump over last year, women are still only 21% of the C-suite, which is crazy making to me. And by the way, most of those women are white, but we're going to get to that later when we talk about brand purpose. So how did you convince a room of mostly male investors that women would embrace buying a bra online?
Yeah, at the time it wasn't easy. Well, one, I had a co-founder who was a male. So to be totally candid, I'm sure that helped. It's hard to know. You know, if I was a single female founder raising money, would I have been able to close around? Would I have been able to raise as much money? No. Would I have gotten a deal done? Maybe. But I think absolutely having a male co-founder helped. But yeah, I mean, one of the questions we got all the time was like, will a woman even buy a bra online, right? Like it just seemed that that would be a difficult hurdle to establish, especially in this category. And, you know, we had different data points. I mean, of course, eventually we found investors who got it, but it wasn't easy. And I do think that many of them, there wasn't just one, would say, oh, let me have my wife, daughter, admin test it out. And, you know, embarrassing, you're in a meeting and you're pitching some male VCs and they call their admin into the meeting and be like, what do you think about third love? Will you try it? I mean, how embarrassing for them, for us. It wasn't great. Now, flash forward to today, I don't think you see that happening, you know, what I'm describing. I think it's changed a bit. And I think the types of female products have, we've taken it up a notch. I mean, with femtech and all kinds of things, bras are like the least quote unquote embarrassing thing that a venture capitalist is going to see today. But certainly in 2013, it was a little bit of like, oh, bras and underwear online. Like, this is out there.
That's remarkable, the rate of change. And literally, you know, you go from having, all right, a lifelong experience of the bra shopping dreading to the kind of hanging out with the guys who created Lyft and thinking about disruption to becoming third love. It's huge, Heidi.
Yeah. I mean, as if it was that easy though. I think it's like, look, we spent years, like from 2013, all of 2014, 2.5 years of just trying to get manufacturing off the ground, trying to figure out product market fit, almost not being able to raise, you know, our A round. It wasn't easy. And most of the time, 99.9% of the time, for every success out there, it's never easy. And you see the output at the end and you're like, wow, this is, you know, amazing. But like the journey's so, so hard. And yeah, I mean, most companies do fail. So we feel very fortunate to have created a brand and a product that will continue to grow and be there. But those early days were really, really hard.
Well, let's keep it up there for a moment. How did you first approach marketing this product to women? Hey, it's Ebi. Sorry to interrupt the action in this episode 26 with Heidi Zack. We are about to talk about how she was able to convince customers to try a whole new way of buying bras. And so I thought it was a good time to hop in and thank you for listening to thus far 25 episodes of Insider Interviews, and also ask how you're approaching convincing your customers. So one of the things that clearly worked for Heidi, and we'll talk about it further in the episode, is podcasting. If you don't have a podcasting strategy, and that's something I can help you with, if you're looking to expand your podcast marketing, I can help you with that. And my audience for Insider Interviews is also comprised of some pretty impressive executives in the media, marketing, and advertising space. So I'm also open to sponsorships. Reach out to me at podcasts@mossappeal.com or just visit mossappeal.com for a little bit more about me and all of the things that I would love to do to help you grow your business. Thank you so much for listening. Here's Heidi. So you've convinced the financiers, and now you have to convince the customers. What were your early stage tactics and what was your positioning?
It's a good question. I still remember our first photo shoot in San Francisco, and the photographer said to us, and he'd worked with like other startups in the past, and he was pretty cheap, and he says to us, what brand are you trying to emulate, right? Because that's really in essence what a lot of startups do. Oh, I want to be a little bit of Apple.
Apple and Volkswagen. Yeah,
exactly. You know, I'm going to mix this together and create something. And we basically said, we don't want to be like any bra brand. We don't want to look like any of them. We don't have a comp. There is no comp for what we're trying to create, because all these bra brands do is shoot skinny, generally white women, with generally small boobs, B cup, and they generally do it in a really sexy way. And whether that's the leaning in, staring at the camera, the pillow fights, the all those things, we were like, that's not the kind of models we want. And that's not the kind of photo shoot we want. And so when we set out to build something radically different from scratch, again, that's hard, right? Because there is no comp. You're kind of paving your own way. It wasn't perfect, but we found a young woman who had a much larger chest. We found models on Craigslist, you know, all kinds of things. And we really were not even working with the traditional modeling agencies. Because again, today, you reach out to any modeling agency, they've a much more vast array of size, shaped, and looking people that you can cast. Yeah. But you're at this time, all the big modeling agencies, I mean, there was barely a few plus size models, and certainly not women with, you know, stretch marks or those kind of things, right? Like that just didn't really exist. And so that was sort of how we thought about the brand and what it looked like. So just trying to do it differently. And of course, the brand's evolved over the years. But then as it relates to the marketing, we came up with this program and we were struggling. What we knew at the time, and this is probably early 2015, we knew we had this 24/7 bra. It's still our best-selling bra today in 2021. And women loved it. So the women who bought it, loved it, kept it, bought more. So we knew the product was good, but we couldn't get women to try it. And nobody knew Third Love. You know, people had never heard of us. We were tiny. And we came up with this program called Try Before You Buy. And we basically said, let's de-risk the situation for the customer. So we put out ads basically saying, you can try this bra for free. Ready to graduate from Victoria's Secret was a big tagline we used. Try this for free. And it really, really took off. And so in this program, we would send a woman a t-shirt bra, store her credit card information, and then charge her after 30 days if she kept the bra. So there was really this idea of no risk up front to the customer. And it worked. And we ran that program for, I mean, close to 3 years, and it allowed us to acquire well over 1 million customers in that time period. And it just was super effective and really, really unique. So that was really the marketing hook.
Excellent hook, so to speak. Got it. So word of mouth, I'm sure, was very impactful. And right around then, podcasting was just starting to take off. And also famously, the canary in the coal mine of a lot of D2C brands are what drove the revenue for podcasters because it was a low-cost entry point for communicating. Did you get into podcasting? What other forms of media did you take on?
Yeah, it's a funny story around podcasts. In 2015, we had three main channels in like what I would call the early days of Third Love. So call it 2015. Facebook was a big one. You couldn't advertise on Instagram at the time. Instagram was just starting. So it was Facebook, podcast, and then the third was YouTube. But podcast in particular, I remember saying to one of our investors, we're starting to advertise on podcasts. It's really effective. It's really, really great. And he was like, podcasts? Like, what? Right. And the early days. But yeah, podcasts were effective for us, still are really, really effective. We have longstanding relationships with a lot of different podcasts, and it's been a really great way and a great platform for us in terms of advertising and building the brand.
And then you did do linear as well.
Yeah, we started testing out TV in sort of 2017, 2018. And now, of course, you have OTT and all the streaming services. So again, that world has evolved tremendously, you know, over the past few years, as well as during the pandemic, with a lot more people watching a lot more content on all these services. I mean, I think linear specifically can work really well, but it also can not work really well. So you got to be careful and thoughtful about the content you're putting out there. Because as I like to always say, marketing and the platforms are one piece of it, but actually most important is the content, the creative, and the messaging. Because if you don't have that right content for any one of these channels, it's not going to work or be effective.
Beautiful. And that teed me up so nicely to talk about brand positioning and purpose. So you're kind of the perfect guest as we dovetail from Black History Month to Women's History Month. And I think it's pretty clear what you've done for women overall, but I want to talk about also what you've done for Black female business owners. Your company is literally and physically in support of women. And you started something in June called the TL Effect. And I could summarize it, but this is your baby. And I would really love for you to describe this initiative.
Yes. So this spring, when there was all kinds of things going on in the world, we were trying to figure out like how Third Love was going to help support and help impact change in the broader community. And so we kind of went through this discussion internally about, you know, do we donate money to a cause? Like, what do we do? And some of our teammates were even like, where are you going to donate money? And I'm thinking to myself, well, we just laid off 30% of our team at the start of COVID. So trying to donate money, it's like, how do I think about that as a CEO? You know, when I think about I can hire X number of people back versus donate money. And so basically, we just took a second to say, let's think on this and not rush and not just be totally reactive to the moment, but do something that is going to impact change in the long term. So that was really the impetus for us with the TL Effect was, what's a program, what's something we can do as a company that, one, lets our team get involved, two, creates some type of actual change that we can look at, hopefully, and see and recognize and see the progress, and three, something that kind of creates a little bit of a flywheel effect. And one night I was at home and the idea came to me because I do some angel investing with early stage companies. And I was like, why don't we create a program where we can help support female founders of color who are early stage? Because that's, you know, a place where we can really make an impact with our team and our company and what we've learned. And we can also promote consumer businesses on our Third Love channels and give them a little more of a voice in a crowded marketplace today. So that was really the goal of the TL Effect. We launched it in June. We picked our first recipient, Ara Sims, founder of QD Nails, and she was fantastic. And so she got a grant, she got mentorship and promotion of her product and brand through the Third Love platforms. And so actually, as luck would have it, we just finalized our three finalists for cohort two, and we'll be interviewing and seeing their pitch, and then we'll pick the finalists, the next finalists for the program. And Ara, the founder of QD, the first winner, is on the panel that's judging those three to pick the winner for the second cohort. So again, you can kind of see how this program is starting to have a bit of a flywheel effect, leverage our prior winner. And again, it's a small thing that we're doing, but I do think there's real energy around it in our company and with our team as well.
Well, it doesn't seem like a small thing, but I do have to say that I believe you built in purpose from the get-go. And that is a huge differentiator. Everything from the product, where you talk about having 80 sizes and invented the half cup size because you're thinking about diversity in not only women, but women's sizes. And also, as part of what you posted on Instagram tied to the TL Effect, I want to read something that you posted. You said, "Our focus on inclusivity has resulted in positive gains for an old school industry previously defined by a narrow concept of beauty." You said, however, the conversation doesn't stop there. "We must also include conversations around race, social economic class, and privilege." And then you required all of your employees to take unconscious bias training too. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, I think that the TL Effect is really our outward facing program for the community at large. And then we also wanted to say, what can we do internally at Third Love to create even a stronger workforce and understanding of each other? And so unconscious bias was our first training we did for D&I efforts. And everyone knows today what it is. But specifically, if you think about unconscious bias, there's a lot of those biases we all hold. Every single person out there has them. Sometimes we don't even realize we do. And sometimes we do realize. And so now we're doing some training around microaggressions. What are they? What do they look like? How do we recognize them? And so really trying to help educate ourselves at Third Love and push the company and each individual forward, you know, in a really healthy and positive way. And having open dialogues really crucial, because if we can't talk about it, right, and we don't know the words to use, then we can't impact change.
Do you believe in your heart that brand purpose supports the bottom line?
100%. It's interesting because that, again, used to be a debate, I would say, 5-10 years ago. And I think today it's very clear that the brands who stand for something and maybe stand for something that not everybody loves are succeeding. I mean, Nike's a great example of taking a, you know, a pretty strong stance. And I think a lot of people were like, wow, they're out there, they're doing it, they're standing for something, and it's worked well for them. I mean, there's tons of examples, but I think what's really important is the brand purpose has to be authentic, right? Right? It has to be true to who you are and what you stand for and what you're building. Otherwise, it can fall flat or I do think a consumer sees through it. So not every company is going to have obviously the same brand purpose, the same values, the same ethos, but making sure you know what yours is and that you can communicate it again, inwardly and outwardly. So to your company, your team, as well as your community, it's important that you have both of those.
You're so real woman oriented. I wonder if you use influencers. I mean, Katie Couric is not a bad person to have in your camp. She, I believe, is an investor, and you did a terrific interview with her on Katie Couric Media last year. I'll add a link to that in the show notes. But what about in your marketing outreach? Do you find a place for influencers or not really?
Yeah, influencers are huge. I mean, we don't use, I would say, a ton of like macro influencers. I mean, I think we use a range in terms of sort of their following, but we've seen a lot of success also with the more micro influencers, right? Which I would deem to be more like the real women, you know? They're real women who have a certain following about a certain topic, and they act as an advocate or a friend to, you know, the people who follow them. And so absolutely, I think influencers are a huge part of our strategy, but we've done a lot more these days also with user-generated content. I think women today, again, are way more comfortable posting photos of themselves in their bra and underwear than they were 5 years ago, when most people might have been like, I'm not. Now today, it's like, yeah, I'll do that. Not everyone, but I do think there's a lot more openness to that. So I think even this idea of real women, to your point, has been, the ecosystem has been increasing of content created by users.
Yeah. And I won't be doing that anytime soon, but I support those who do.
Me too. I'm with you. But
okay. And so we joked in the beginning about organizing our sock drawer, our underwear drawers during pandemic, but how else have you, to use that word, pivoted as a company during the pandemic, both in your marketing and actually your business itself?
Yeah. So I think on the business side, we really switched in 2020 last year to focusing on profitability, really just making sure we were being as efficient as possible, spending, you know, the right amount of money, not overspending. And we were able to effectively do that quite quickly. And so I do think from a silver lining of COVID, for me, that's definitely one. It's this idea that it makes you relook at every aspect of your business. When something like that happens, you're like, let me take a step back and just like look at everything and then change it, basically change almost every aspect. And so I think there was a very much an opportune moment. I mean, as it relates to product and marketing, we launched our lounge collection yesterday, sleepwear, joggers, things that can go from sleep to outside, to walk the dog, to a Zoom call. So certainly really thinking through some of the changes in our customer's behavior, what she's wearing, whether that's wireless or sleep, like making sure we're launching products to support a woman with what she needs, right? And then marketing, I mean, we've done remote photo shoots. So if you go check out our lounge and the images are beautiful, those were done remotely with a photographer boyfriend and a woman who may or may not have been a model. And that's how that content got created, a remote photo shoot done basically kind of virtually with our team at Third Love. So radically different ways to produce content that you just need to do. So I think there's been a lot of good lessons learned.
That's fantastic. And your photography is really gorgeous, whether it is by the boyfriend or the pro or whatever. And I love the variety of models. It reflects that aspect of if you can see it, you can be it. So there's something to that as well. So I want to wrap it up with just a couple more questions. Heidi, on the personal side, if you could do an insider interview with any person, living or dead, we'll just open it up, who would it be with?
Oh, this is always such a hard one. I mean, one of the women I've always admired is Oprah Winfrey. I mean, I think just like what she was able to do before, like she was so early, right, to be a disruptor and to be an independent woman who like made her own fortune. But I still feel like we don't know a lot about her. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like we do and we don't. And I think that would be somebody I would just have a zillion and one questions for.
Yeah, I agree. I am an Oprah fan as well, from what I know.
Yeah, right. But it's like, you want to know all those other things. Like, so I feel like there's just so much more to be told there that, you know, she'll never probably tell. But
and I do really want to go play with her dogs.
Yeah.
So last question, you were, as we said, hanging out with the guys who invented Lyft, you disrupted the women's undergarment business. This might be a gold mine for some listener out there, but what are the other frustrations you have right now that you think are worthy of creating or disrupting a whole new industry for?
I think the biggest thing that we're seeing right now is it'll be interesting to see how much this changes, but the idea of connection and how you create connection virtually, because I don't think the world will totally go back to how it was. And what I mean by that is, like, how do you create these abilities for people to, like, find each other, to connect, to get advice? And what I'm kind of trying to allude to is, like, sort of what Airbnb did for properties. It's like, how do you do that for human connection?
Ooh.
I know that's real high level, but I just think there'll be a lot that we see in terms of innovation in that broader space. And we see some of these things in, like, the Clubhouse app, right? You know, those type of platforms, but I'm talking about a kind of a next level to that.
Yeah. I just got completely addicted to Clubhouse. And a friend of mine, Joseph Jaffe, said something in a room that I thought was brilliant, which is that it'll be interesting to see what Clubhouse does to things like podcasting, and will it be complementary or will it cannibalize it? It's very easy to hop into a room right now, and I feel a connection with people when I'm in those rooms. So there's something to voice, right?
100%. And also the live nature of it, right? Because there's the idea that you are a listener, or there's the idea of being the participant. And so even if you're not quote unquote participating, right, in Clubhouse, there's an activeness of being present. And so how does that kind of go into other areas? It'll be interesting to see.
Do you have any plans to have Third Love presence or start a room or a club on Clubhouse?
No, we haven't really thought about that yet. You know, I haven't really had a ton of time to explore. To your point earlier, I feel like between Third Love and my kids, like, I just don't have a ton of free time. And I listen and I'm on meetings all day. So I haven't gone there. But yeah, that's an interesting idea.
I'll send you an invite if you want.
Awesome.
Okay. Well, out of respect for your time and the fact that, oh my gosh, it's Heidi Zack, I'll let you go now with huge appreciation. And thank you so much for your time and all you've done for women and our boobs.
Thank you. It was fun to be on here with you.
I hope you got some good insider scoop from this episode of Insider Interviews with me, E.B. Moss. And I hope you'll follow Insider Interviews on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and let me know if you have a question or suggestion for a next guest. My theme music was composed and performed by the incomparable and Grammy-winning John Clayton. If I can help you with your company's podcast, please find me at mossappeal.com. And thanks again for listening.